If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Prehistory can often feel incredibly distant, but something that can bring us closer to the human experience in this time well before written records is art. And fortunately, we still have some engravings and paintings that survive from the Paleolithic era, principally on the wall of caves and famously at places like Lascaux and Altamira. In the latest of our Everything You Wanted to Know series, David Musgrove put your questions on cave art to Paul Pettit, Professor of Prehistoric Archaeology at the University of Durham and author of a new book, Homo Sapiens Rediscovered: How Science is Revolutionising Our Origin Story. To start, David asked Paul to explain exactly what we mean by prehistoric, or more specific, Paleolithic cave art.
So, this is drawing, painting and engraving on cave walls, as the name implies. And although we do have the odd bits of art that belongs to the Bronze Age, Neolithic or later, it is almost entirely Paleolithic in age. That is to say, it belongs to the Old Stone Age, the earliest archaeological period in prehistory we have.
Let's delve into the date a bit more there. So you said it's mostly from the Paleolithic. That's a very big period, spans an enormous amount of time, doesn't it? How is cave art dated? And then a subsidiary question from one of our listeners, Susan Pollitz, who wants to know, how far back can prehistoric cave art be dated?
Right. Well, originally it couldn't be dated, certainly until the last 10 or 20 years. So really, prehistorians had to rely on relative schemes, looking at examples where one piece of art had been superimposed upon another, and just making simple guesses that obviously we're dealing with two phases there. So we had two grand schemes of a development of art throughout the course of the Upper Paleolithic, let's say from around 40,000 years ago down to the end of the Ice Age, a little after 12,000 years ago. However, we do now have certainly two techniques that we can use to date it directly. The first is radiocarbon, which of course can date anything that once lived. So if we have cave art that's been drawn with charcoal, we can date that. So we can scrape a little bit off now, and thankfully the technology is such that we only need minute amounts, so we're not really damaging any art. But of course it's limited to charcoal, and black colour can be obtained by mineral pigments such as manganese, which cannot be dated, and a lot of the art is red, and it's hematite or ochre, which can't be dated as well. So we're limited to those examples, but when we do have charcoal, we can scrape a bit off. But the important thing there is that the radiocarbon is dating actually the burning event that produced that charcoal, which may or may not be the same as using that charcoal for the art itself. So there are some limitations with it. The other technique that can be used, which I've been far more involved in, is uranium thorium. And this, rather like radiocarbon, is based on radioactive decay. And we're not dating the art directly there. We're dating stalactites that the art may have been created on, which would provide a maximum age for the art, or most commonly stalactites which have dripped and formed over the art, which provide minimum ages. So with ideally a combination of the two, and ancillary data like relative superimpositioning, this kind of thing, we can get a pretty decent hanging of the development of art over time. And to go to the second question, what we can tell now is we have some uranium thorium dates of stalactites over examples of red ochre art, which tell us that the art is older than 64,000 years ago. These are three sites in Spain currently, three caves, which we have for that. So this is at least 20,000 years before our own species, Homo sapiens, turn up there. So the most likely candidates are the Neanderthals, the indigenous European humans that were on the scene long before we arrived. The interesting thing is these aren't figurative art. These aren't depictions of anything. They are extensions of the body, really, where Neanderthals had placed their hands on the wall and spat a red pigment at it to leave the ghost of the hand, or they've coloured their fingertips with a pigment and pressed them to the wall and so on. So it's quite interesting. It might suggest Neanderthals were doing very different things with their cave art than we were.
Okay, that's a great answer. There's a couple of things I'd just like to pick up on. It sounds like you kind of really need very specific conditions sometimes to get a really good dating opportunity. Is that right? You kind of, if you've got the stalactites in the right place and you've got the right sort of composition of the artwork itself, you kind of like, it's not going to work in every example, is it?
Exactly. If you have a cave with no charcoal drawings, you can't use radiocarbon. And if you have a cave that hasn't been relatively sealed and moist in the past, then you have no stalactites that can't be dated either. So by comparing the themes and styles of art in one cave to another, which is similar, where the art has been dated, we can hang these together, if you like, at least in a very broad sense. So actually, while in absolute terms, 95% of caves with art have not been dated, we can at least suspect on pretty decent grounds roughly when they date to.
And then the other point you brought up there, which is absolutely fascinating, is this idea that Neanderthals were involved in making art. And that sort of predicts a question we've got later on, which was, did Neanderthals produce cave art? Could you just very quickly sketch out the relationship as we understand it today? And this has changed a lot, hasn't it? This is a moving picture of the relationship and dynamic between Neanderthals and modern Homo sapiens, the species that we are today.
Absolutely. And ancient DNA has really clarified this picture. So Neanderthals were the original human indigenes in Europe and Central Asia. They evolved from probably the same ancestor species as we did from at least 500,000 years ago down to their extinction around and about 40,000 years ago. So for most of their existence, there is no Homo sapiens in Europe. We're, of course, an African species. We evolved there and gradually dispersed several times, increasingly further into Eurasia every time. So when Homo sapiens first begins moving up into the north and into the southern parts of Europe, Neanderthal groups, or at least some of them, were probably still around. So the genetics comes in at this point, which shows, as is very well known now, we share about 2% of our DNA with them. So clearly there has been some interbreeding. Probably that's been reduced over time. So perhaps we originally shared about 4%. And what that suggests is that we were meeting them on occasion and mating on occasion as well. Similarly with the Denisovans, who are more of a, they're contemporaries with Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, but more of a Central and East Asian species as well. So I think what we have to think of is that on the peripheries of their ranges, Neanderthals in Europe, Denisovans in Central Asia, Homo sapiens in Africa and the Near East, they would meet and mate occasionally, and that would explain that level of genetic difference. But essentially, the question is whether they had any meaningful interactions, if they shared ideas as well as genes too. And this has always been a bit of a thorny issue, and I suspect that they didn't. We don't have any similar archaeological items on Neanderthal sites or on early Homo sapiens sites. You know, they're not trading javelin tips or anything like that. What they do do, however, is share a broadly similar visual culture. They're wearing ornaments made from the same types of materials, typically fox canines that have just been pierced so you can suspend them as a necklace, the odd animal bone and so on. It might suggest that Neanderthals, or very late Neanderthals, when they did come into contact with Homo sapiens, they were sharing some kind of very similar, very simple visual culture, so they all understood very basic messages between them. But I wouldn't want to over exaggerate that. I think these examples of the two meeting were very, very rare.
Okay. And I should say, you sketch out that story very nicely in your new book, Homo Sapiens Rediscovered, as well. So if listeners want more on that, then have a look in the book. But let's get back to the cave art specifically, because that's what we're supposed to be delving into. We need to establish where this art is geographically, and also just geographically first. Where do we find this cave art?
Yeah, was in terms specifically of Paleolithic cave art, which we're talking about here, we actually find it at each end of Eurasia. Most of it, and certainly historically, we've understood most of it, is in Europe, and specifically in Western Europe. But we have examples now that we have very good dates for, uranium, thorium again, right over in Indonesia. And they are rather similar to what we have in Europe, which suggests that perhaps Homo sapiens at least had a very widespread tradition as they dispersed out of Africa for the first time. But when we think of cave art traditionally, it's effectively French and Spanish, with a few outliers. We have a little bit in the Czech Republic, a little bit in Germany, a little bit in Britain as well. So we should never think that everyone in the Upper Paleolithic was doing cave art whenever they found a cave. It was probably only specific groups, and those typically in the west of Europe.
And you're absolutely right to pick me up on saying we're talking about Paleolithic cave art here. You do get later cave art all over the world, don't you? There's all sorts of interesting examples.
Yes, exactly. And often reinvented themes as well, like hand stencils and so on.
Mm. Brilliant. And then in terms of the clues in the name here a bit, in terms of cave art, it's found in caves, but where in caves and what sort of caves?
It's actually part of a very widespread tradition of art that is on the body or on small portable objects, on probably outside locations, cliff edges and so on, where it's of course eroded away. It can be in the back walls of very shallow rock shelters that were used as campsites, and it can be at any location, in caves, in small caves, in the daylight zone of the mouth, or very deep inside. We have examples of it a few kilometres into some caves, like Rufignac, south of France, for example. But the interesting thing is, while it really differs, and many caves can have a handful of images, quite simple, quite close to their entrances, others can often have several dozen or several hundred, and they can really go back to the deepest part of the cave that humans can navigate through. So sometimes one gets the impression that it's almost a human marking of the cave to show that they've, you know, effectively explored the whole depths of the cave and humanized it using that art, if you like. So it's very different rules. Sometimes the art can be very obvious. Think of all those wonderful animals literally swirling around your head in Lascaux, a very public space. Or it can be very personal, almost hidden, the odd little piece. And one gets the impression that in many cases, it was the creation of the art that was important, rather than a very modern notion of I'm going to draw a bison so everybody can look back and appreciate it.
Yeah, I've visited a few of these caves. I'm sure you've visited them many times. And I was very struck once by, you really had to go quite deep into the cave, and the guide with his flashlight was, you know, it was guiding us along, telling us to not hit our heads and stuff. And it was like, we're really going on a journey deep inside here. So there was obviously, well, actually, let's go on to the technicalities of how the art was made, because that leads on quite nicely. A question from Marie Sandvig wanted to know what was in the pigments to make them last so long. And then a broader question, a search engine question, which was, how was the art actually produced? So we have to imagine that there was people with lighting of some sort. They weren't doing it in the dark. What do we know about how the art was produced?
Yeah, that's a great question from Marie, actually. So, yes, we need light as long as we're getting out of the daylight zone in the cave mouths. So we have lots of evidence of that, thankfully. A simple torch, by which, of course, I mean a bundle of reeds or twigs soaked in animal fat, you know, held up aloft. We have traces of those, rather like a cigarette when it builds up lots of ash. We flick it to rejuvenate it. We have little marks of charcoal left on cave walls where they've done the same to a torch, but also little stone lamps. There's a beautiful carved sandstone example in Lascaux that was left there, but often these are very simple little pebbles of natural stone with little indentations in. The point being, it's a light that really only illuminates a couple of meters. It's constantly moving. And consequently, it shows that our Paleolithic artists were experiencing this art in a very, very different way to us. We have bright light, it's a still light, and so on. So the movement and the shadows associated with it, and particularly the position of the human viewer, were all important. So from a modern perspective, we have to think of it really as a form of installation art. So the way one moves can cause the animals to move, the way the light flickers and so on. So we see it now as still images reproduced in books and so on. But for a Paleolithic viewer, I think this is all part of that mysterious journey into the depths of the earth.
That's a very evocative image you describe there. Let's come back to that. But what about the pigments and Marie's question?
Ah, yes. So, well, the art can be engraved first. Much of the art we have is very shallow line engravings with stone tools. Very difficult to see. That's an example of a more personal type of art rather than a public one meant to be seen perhaps by many people. And that doesn't really reproduce well in big glossy books, so you know, we tend to focus in these more on the drawings, in other words, as a modern charcoal drawer would do, or the paintings. Sometimes a wet pigment was applied with probably a brush of horsehair or a leather pad, something like that. And finally, these pigments can be spat as well. So if you imagine holding your hands or the outer side of your hands parallel to each other and using that to guide yourself and spitting, you can create a line that's broadly quite sharp as well. So there's a number of techniques that can be used, and typically the pigments are either black, manganese, or charcoal, or red, or a variation of it, and that's hematite. We tend to call it red ochre, but in fact, ochre can outcrop in yellow, biscuit brown colours, even violet. So that's the palette. And that might have been important for the fact that in a low light environment, red is fairly visible, whereas black becomes blended with the shadows. So again, it's a play on this. But Marie's question as to, you know, what were they made of to survive so much? Certainly, as anybody who's wiped some ochre on their hands will know, it you know, takes a while to get off because it's a mineral and so on. But it's actually the micro environments of the caves themselves that really protect it. Normally, they're fairly stable in their temperature. They're cool and not cold. It doesn't oscillate, you know. And if you don't have insects, you know, chewing the surfaces of the wall, you don't have bears rubbing past it, you know, you don't have frost thaw action, all this sort of thing. That's why it tends to survive. And even better if you have a stalactite slowly forming over it. So probably, we tend to assume that art was probably all over the landscape. We do have open air examples such as Portugal's Coa Valley and associated areas in Spain. But of course, the glacial period, frost thaw action and this kind of thing tends to obliterate everything in the open air. So what we're dealing with really is the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, where caves have just been relatively sealed environments. And think of the textiles in the tomb of Tutankhamun as well, you know, for the very same reason it tends to survive.
Brilliant. Okay. Now, we've got a couple of questions here which lead on from what you've just been talking about, trying to understand the artists themselves and what we know about them. So we've got Nicholas Serges who wanted to know whether the creation of the art was a social activity. And Nicholas talks about the handprints that you were just describing, saying there's examples of child-size handprints high up on a wall, which suggests that maybe somebody was on someone else's shoulders. I don't know if that's true or not. And then EMG wanted to know whether we can tell whether the artists were left or right-handed. What do we know about the people who must have created the art?
Yes. Yeah, well, Nicholas is absolutely right. We have, it's actually a print of a child's hand about 2 metres up on the wall of Cosquer Cave near Nice. And it's actually it's on what is known as moon milk. It's the breakdown of the carbonate rich cave wall. So it's basically a whitish mud. And historically, it's been associated with lots of magical things. You know, it's actually rich in calcium, so it's medicinally quite useful. So it probably had some kind of significance back in the period of the cave artists. So the idea of this is, because it's definitely a child's hand grabbing some of this material, the child wouldn't have been able to reach up, so it's been held up or sitting on the shoulders of a human there as well. And we do actually have in other caves footprints, naked feet, which are children as well. And we do have sometimes traces, lines produced by moving the fingers, rubbing the fingers along these soft, muddy cave walls. And they're consistent with the size of children's fingers. So it doesn't seem to have been exclusive to adults on occasion, but of course we're dealing with some 500 caves and at least 25,000 years of figurative art, so I wouldn't like to generalize and say it was always everyone who could do it. In some caves it seems to have been a very personal, almost private thing. One individual there, perhaps even alone, communing with the darkness, something like that. But in others, we have these grand compositions, Lascaux, Altamira, Chauvet Cave, for example, El Castillo in Spain, where it certainly seems to have been a communal act. We can actually tell where pigments were being sourced from using geochemical analysis, and we can tell, let's say, for Lascaux, that pigments were sourced for several tens of kilometres in pretty much all directions of the compass. That's probably a sign that several groups were coming together there for a few months of the year, eating reindeer. There's lots of reindeer remains scattered around the floor there, and probably all doing their rituals and singing their songs and producing their art all together as this shared activity. We can tell about handedness too. Sometimes with hand stencils, we can tell that both left and right hands were produced, but we don't know if the person whose hand is being stenciled was the one spitting the pigment there as well. In some respects, it could be a pair of people doing it, again, as something more communal. But often we can tell from, say, the direction of brush strokes, even the orientation of animals, that, as in the modern world, 80% or so of the artists were right-handed, as far as we can tell. If any of your listeners, say, imagine if they're right-handed, if they imagine drawing an animal from the side profile, my guess is that they will start with the head, and that head will be to the left, and therefore the animal will wind up being facing to the left as well. So various little tricks we can deploy like that to show that handedness and brain lateralization was pretty much the same as today.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Listeners, if you fancy having a go at that and try and draw a bison or something, tell us how you get on, and tell us if Paul's thesis is correct there. Right, let's move on a bit to the sort of the big question, which is form and function, I suppose. So Kate at the with the excellent name Kate at How Why Who When wants to know: do the styles or subjects vary much across the world? And Brian Page similarly wants to know about stylistic changes over time. Whilst Richard Goldstein has the question: was cave art in one location influenced by art in another location? So sort of lots of big questions about the similarities between what we see. Can you sort of try and take all those in one go?
Absolutely. So the overwhelmingly dominant theme is animals. We hardly get representations of anything else. We certainly don't get depictions of landscapes or anything like that. There's no rivers, hills, or whatever there. And those animals that are depicted are overwhelmingly the herbivores of the European steppes that were so critical to survival. You know, they formed the major prey of our hunter-gatherers in the Upper Paleolithic. So the European art is dominated by wild horse, that's by far and away the most commonly depicted, by bovids, bison, or the extinct cattle, aurochs, by cervids, in other words, red deer, and occasionally reindeer, and also ibex in montane areas like the Pyrenees, and then occasionally mammoth and one or two other animals, woolly rhino, for example. Over the other side of Eurasia, of course, we have a slightly different spectrum of animals that were hunted there. So in Indonesia, the species depicted include the so-called pig deer, the Babirusa, now extinct. So these are always a reflection of those animals that hunter-gatherers are critically dependent on. So these do indeed change over time. So figurative art appears not when Homo sapiens first disperse into Europe. In my opinion, they're not doing cave art so much at that point, but perhaps within 2,000 or 3,000 years of them being present here. When it does appear, let's say for the sake of argument, about 33,000 years ago, the animals are fairly simplistic. They're simple outlines. They're obviously identifiable to species. You know, if you're dealing with a horse or if you're dealing with a bison and so on. But there's very little in the way of internal detail, you know, their pelage or anything like that. And over time, certainly that level of naturalism increases. Also, the grouping together of animals that were originally quite isolated individual examples, we get more of what we might think of as scenes. We get the introduction of perspective as well. It's not something that's that common in Upper Paleolithic art, but over time it does increase. And also a concern with representing movement, almost like comic strips where you have several legs, you know, two or three legs too many, or two heads on an animal that should be read rather like a flick book style animation and so on. So we can use traits like that as a chronological indicator. And then finally, there is stylistic change too. So simply the way one would draw, say, a horse's mane that, say, 20,000 years ago forms just one continuous line from the horse's nose right through to its back, to, let's say, individual hairs standing upright in a very aggressive stallion, which comes a little later. So the way hooves are depicted, this kind of thing. So yes, stylistic change seems to be very, very useful to us for being able to periodize art, if we haven't dated it directly, to within 1,000 or 2,000 years, which to your listeners might seem horrifically imprecise, but you know, in terms of 25,000 years or more of Paleolithic art, then you know, it's pretty good for us.
Yeah, got to work with what you've got, haven't you? So you've talked about this briefly, but Chel Belsky here has a very good question, which is, why are humans so rarely depicted in Western cave art? And, you know, as you said, it's mostly animals, but there are some examples of humans and human figures, aren't there?
There are indeed, although quite rightly you've hit the nail on the head, they are always relatively underrepresented. And for that matter, they're always very poorly done as well. With the animals, whatever the level of skill, they're pretty decent representations. I certainly couldn't create a drawing of a horse anything like as good as an example of Paleolithic art. But the humans are always odd. There's always a bit of an animalness about them. You know, they might be, they might have a human-like body, but their head looks a bit bird-like or bear-like and so on. So depending on who you're listening to, we might have anything between a couple of hundred and 600 or so images out of thousands of animals. But really, if we start thinking, some of these probably represent bears that are rearing on their legs and so on. So if we have a critical approach, humans are even rarer. We don't really have anything that could be said to be portraits, except for heads engraved onto stone plaquettes in a French cave called La Marche, which do actually represent faces. And it's very tempting to see that here we have individuals about 15,000 to 16,000 years old that are still portraitized in stone. But humans are, however one looks at it, exceptionally rare and exceptionally odd. And the reason why, well, people have speculated that perhaps there was a taboo depicting humans, which there isn't for animals and so on. But I don't think necessarily we have evidence for that. I think there's two reasons why humans aren't depicted. The first is because it's all about prey animals. There are carnivores occasionally represented. They're always very rare. It's all about those animals. And if there was an underpinning religious system, a reason, a ritual reason for creating the art, then certainly it pertains to creation. And hunter-gatherers tend to think of themselves as borrowing from the environment only, and they're very concerned with propitiating the spirits, you know, not taking too many horses without doing their appropriate rituals to bring them back into the world. And I think first then, that explains why, of course, the concern is with animals rather than depicting humans. But there is, I think, another equally important reason why humans aren't depicted, and that is because it is an installation art and humans are there participating in it. So you don't need to draw them. If your presence, your movement, the way your light source is flickering and so on is such an important part of that process as well. So humans are there in person, in the flesh, so to speak, celebrating the creation of life of these animals that are so important.
So that question leads us very nicely into the big question and the most prominent search engine question, which is, why was prehistoric cave art made? Now, people have been thinking, obviously, looking at this cave art, it invites reflection, it invites contemplation, doesn't it? And people have been contemplating and trying to work out what the hell it means ever since it was discovered 100, 150 years ago, whenever that was. When I was studying archaeology, I remember there were theories like it was just because it's art for art's sake. It was a mental mind map. It was to help with hunting, a hunting aid. Many, many theories. Could you briefly sketch through the leading ones and maybe give us a sense about what you think it's all about?
Yeah, as with art in the modern world, of course, there were elements of a number of reasons for it. And certainly, I think the location, the extent to which the danger, the difficulty of which getting to the point where it was created suggests that it was important and there was probably a ritual and religious reason behind it. But although umbrella theories about it that explain all art, you know, on the back of a postcard, are unfashionable now. And we now know they say a lot more about the people who forwarded these ideas. So when art was first discovered, rediscovered and authenticated, we're in the late Victorian world, early Edwardian world, for which really art was something to cheer up the walls of your industrial cottage or something like that. So the first idea was that, well, it was art for art's sake. You know, it's cold outside. You got an evening to spare. Let's draw a horse and that kind of thing. That's a very anachronistic Western way of thinking of art. And I don't think that really caught on. Then, of course, all of the wonderful ethnographic information reaching Britain in the early 20th century led specialists to propose that, like all of these small-scale societies then in the modern world, the art functioned in a magical way, and it was what an anthropologist might call today vault magic, like voodoo, you know, cause and effect magic. So you want to have success in the hunt tomorrow, so what you do is you draw your picture of your horse, you do your rituals and so on, that empowers you and so on. And actually we often have what arrows, as in the sign, depicted within the bodies of animals quite often. In Neo Cave in the French Pyrenees, which can be visited by the public, we have a lot of these, and bison. So the hunting magic, which actually was formulated on the basis of Neo Cave, does hold at points as well. But whether it becomes before a hunt to propitiate, empower you, or whether it comes afterwards to thank the bison spirits, you know, for this, is a moot point. Another suggestion, when we do have not cave art, but figurines carved of females, often obese, sometimes pregnant females. Fertility has been suggested, but again, these are hunter-gatherer groups who would be concerned with keeping relatively small and, you know, not over-exploiting the environment. So that never really stuck. And then when we come through the 1960s and 70s, the information age, people suggest, well, maybe these are, you know, didactic aids, maybe they're classroom images and so on, which I've never bought. You know, if you want to show your kids what a reindeer looks like, you show them a reindeer. And if you want to show them what their hoof prints look like, you show them their hoof prints. You certainly don't go into the depths of a dark and dangerous cave to draw images when you can draw them on hides in your campsite, on the walls of your teepee or something like that. And then I suppose finally, the last umbrella theory, which has gained a lot of traction, came about in the late 80s, and that is the idea that it arises through visions experienced during altered states of consciousness, and therefore was part of a shamanic system, to borrow one word of the Tungus people, and so on. And of course, that reflects more New Age concerns, and Neolithic archaeology was getting all traveller-like and this kind of thing at the time. So I've never really had much traction with the shamania argument, as a colleague calls it. But really, since then, these kind of largely anglophone and popularising umbrella notions have fallen by the wayside. If I had to say what would be one of the most dominant functions of it, I would certainly say it's a celebration of creation. The animals are often placed as if they're dripping out of the ceiling. They're placed on bosses that hang down, or they're placed as if they're coming out of cracks. It seems very obvious that caves were thought of as places where animals or their spirits came into the world. And perhaps it's, I would see it as a form of midwifery, if you like. You know, you go into a cave, our brains are wired to make sense of these. We all do it. You look up in the clouds, you see a poodle, or you cut open a tomato and see the face of Jesus, and this kind of thing. This pareidolia was certainly at work in the cave. So you see a line, a natural crack on the wall. It looks like the dorsal area, the back of a horse. So you help that horse come into this world by completing it, by drawing or engraving it, and so on. But as I say, there's that. If that might be a relatively overriding concern, sometimes there's personal celebrations. Sometimes it's we're all getting together and celebrating life, celebrating creation, remembering that we all sing from the same song sheet and bring our own pigments to the party, so to speak.
So broadly speaking, you're saying that we need to be a bit careful on these big overarching theories, and really we need to look at the context and stories going on in a particular environment and try and understand what's going on there, which stands to reason because we're talking of such a long period and such a diverse and disparate sort of concept, aren't we?
You got it. Exactly. So, you know, the concerns of, let's say, an artist around 27,000, 28,000 years ago, a Gravettian, as we would call them, were presumably very different to one around 15,000, let's say, the middle and late Magdalenian, as we would call that. So, no, just as themes and particularly styles change over this vast period, then one assumes that broad concerns or variability, the diversity of reasons to do this art, changed as well.
A good sort of follow-on question from this, from Shining Pyramid, is the art we see considered as intended to be final, or have spaces been reused and sort of been stuff being put on top of it? What's the answer to that?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because we do have examples of both. Lascaux seems to have been created in pretty much one go. Over 2,000 images, highly organised, there for show, probably there to be revisited and so on. Quite often, it's a fire and forget art. You know, for whatever reason, I'm going to engrave a reindeer on the walls of this cave. That's it. That's the important thing. But as we've been delving into using dating, laboratory dating methods, particularly uranium-thorium, we can tell that caves that we thought were often decorated in one go actually were decorated in several phases with thousands of years between them. Altamira is a very good example of this. And sometimes art has been placed over other pieces of art. Sometimes art has been touched up. Very famously in Pêche-Mêle Cave in the Lot department of France, we have two horses that are drawn facing in opposite directions with lots of spots on them, the spotted horses. This cave can be visited, Pêche-Mêle too, but we can see that there the mane of one has been, and the chest area has been touched up at a later date. We don't know how later at all, but we can see there was sometimes a concern with restoring, if you like, and sometimes obliteration. Even in Lascaux, we have several heads of wild cattle or oxen completely obliterated, probably very quickly by a large aurochs painted over them. So again, it's a very Western concept that, you know, art is there to be continually enjoyed, it belongs to us all and so on. One gets the impression that whatever the issues of access were, and they probably changed, it was the creation of the art and whatever the associated activities were that were really important about it.
You've mentioned some of the key examples there. If our listeners are inspired to go and have a look at some of these places, you've mentioned Lascaux, kind of probably the most famous type site, which has been recreated, hasn't it? It's because of concerns about the impacts of visitors. So that's one to visit. You mentioned Altamira in the Spanish Pyrenees, Chauvet Cave in the Ardèche, isn't it? Where would you suggest people go to if they want to get a sense of this art?
Three centres. So you could either go to the Dordogne, focus on the village of Les Izis, the so-called capital of prehistory, where there's a stunning museum anyway. That's where you can visit Lascaux 4, a stunning reconstruction, and several other caves, Font de Gaume, Les Comberelles. There's a real great number of them, easily accessible from Les Izis. The second region would be the French Pyrenees, Ariège, where one can visit Nio, Bediac and others, massive caves with lots of art. Nio alone would repay that that effort. And Gargasse, which has several hundred hand stencils, isn't too far away as well. Or finally, Cantabria, so northern Spain, where one can visit the replication of Altamira, one can visit El Castillo, several smaller caves as well. So any one of those three, and of course having friends and colleagues in all of them, I'm not going to single one out. Do the lot of them as a follow the pilgrimage route, you know, to Compostela, and take them all in at the same time.
Absolutely. Right, last question from me. Where's the future of cave art research going? You talk a lot in your new book about sort of the scientific revolution on Paleolithic archaeology. What are we going to learn about cave art? What are we going to explore and discover in the years ahead?
Yeah, well, I hope there is a decent future for it. There's not many practitioners of it who actually get underground and spend time researching it. So I hope we can maintain that. But certainly we'll develop more our idea of the chronological change over these broad periods of time. I mean, the results showing that Neanderthals were producing non-figurative art before 64,000 years ago only came out about a few years ago. So there'll be plenty more surprises in dating alone. And as techniques continue to improve, when we can really use microscopic amounts of material to date and therefore convince curators that they can let us take a scalpel to their precious art, that alone will be quite important too. But for me, and I'm biased here, I think understanding the underlying psychology of the art, and bearing in mind this is the earliest appearance of human art, so our visual psychological systems played much more of an active role in what that art looked like when it emerged and how it changed over time. And this is something we can investigate scientifically. I'm working with our professor of visual psychology, Bob Kentridge at Durham. He works particularly on the visual system. And I've mentioned pareidolia, that fact that the brain has evolved to make very snap decisions about potential dangers. So if you've got a bear approaching you and you see it out of the corner of your eye, obviously you don't want to think, it's probably a rock, and ignore it. And you don't want to have to take your time to look around and just ascertain that it is a bear. So our brains have evolved to make snap decisions. It's better to say, my word, it's a bear, run, and then just be embarrassed than it's actually only a rock, you know. So that's how our brain is working in caves. And we can use cutting edge visual psychological techniques. So we can track people's eyes, of course, and see what parts of rock they're drawn to and this sort of thing. But one thing we have been doing, we recreate a virtual cave in virtual reality. We take 3D photogrammetric images of real art. We've done this for El Castillo Cave, for example, in Spain. We superimpose that in the cave. We give the participant a simulated light level, so they hold up a lantern that simulates what it would have been like for an Ice Age explorer, as it were. And then we digitally remove the art, and then we just see where their eyes are actually drawn to. We get them to explore the cave, and we build up a heat map of those spots in the cave that eyes are often drawn to. We ask them, what do you see there? And 9 times out of 10, they'll be drawn to the same area. They'll say, well, it looks a bit like a horse there. And sure enough, we can then put the actual digital photo back on there and show that it's a horse. So that's just one example of a number of things we're doing. So for me, really getting scientifically at how our brains determine the nature of the earliest art is probably one of the most promising, as well as that bread and butter of refining our dating of it even further too.
That was Professor Paul Pettit. His book, Homo Sapiens Rediscovered: How Science is Revolutionising Our Origin Story, is published now by Thames and Hudson. And if you'd like to get involved in the visual psychology project that Paul mentioned in the interview, then check out household-art.com to see if you can decipher what's depicted in examples of Ice Age art. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.